Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour, our roundtable podcast about what we're watching, reading, and listening to. I'm Stephen Thompson. I'm a writer and editor with NPR Music. This week, we've got two far-reaching discussions of Captain America: Civil War, one with our panel and one on-stage interview in which Linda Holmes sits down with the movie's directors. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week, so stick around.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Try out the new NPR One app for your phone for conversations you won't hear anywhere else. This week, find Guy Raz's exclusive interview with TED curator Chris Anderson, where they discuss the TED phenomenon and the secrets to giving a great TED talk. Find their conversation by searching TED Radio on the NPR One app, where you can also find stories from your local station and more great podcasts. NPR One is in your app store now.
We are all Captain America all the time this week, but before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
Gene Demby, what do you do at NPR?
I'm a blogger at NPR's Code Switch.
Now, you will notice that there are only three of us, and that we are currently without our host, Linda Holmes. You see, last week, Linda interviewed Captain America directors Joe and Anthony Russo. And we're going to have an excerpt of that interview later on in this show, but since Linda will have more of an interviewer hat on in that segment, we all felt it best that she sit out this discussion, much as we'll miss her. Now, in case you are way behind on your superhero movies, Captain America: Civil War is a sequel to Captain America: Winter Soldier, but it's also building on the dozen other films in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And in this one, loosely based on Mark Miller's Civil War comics from about a decade ago, the central conflict is internal, about whether to cooperate with UN plans to essentially co-opt the Avengers, but also what to do with Captain America's old friend Bucky Barnes, who is either a good guy or a bad guy, depending on who's controlling him. Long story short, a dozen Avengers wind up split into equal warring factions, and lots of fighting ensues. Glenn, what did you think of Captain America Civil War?
I really liked it. I think because we have been living in this universe for a while, and the conflicts actually grow out of things that have been set up in previous films. And we know these characters. I think it succeeds because of the strength of Chris Evans' performance. He doesn't get a lot of credit for it, but that is an incredibly difficult role to play, Captain America, because you're a decent guy, and decent is often boring cinematically. He gives us some layers to this thing. It's a quieter performance than Tony Stark, obviously, but it really works. The presence of Tom Holland as Spider-Man kind of revolutionizes this movie, energizes it at a point when it needs some energy. And we're going to be talking about that guy for a long time.
Sure.
And I can't imagine ever saying, I'm looking forward to the next Spider-Man movie before going to see this film. I really am. That kid is such a natural. He's such a presence, and he really electrifies things. So I dug it. I think it improves on Civil War, the books. We can talk about that or not. But
yes.
It makes a lot more sense. These motivations land in a way they don't noticeably land. It also does something smart by pivoting away from the whole, should we register or not, which is an ideological discussion, which is what the books were dominated by, to a personal stakes thing about the relationship. I'm going to go ahead and call it the love story between Bucky and Cap.
Sure.
Which makes you realize why these guys would come to blows. In the books, you never understood that. It was an abstract concept that never really felt like something that you would just wail on somebody else for. This makes sense to me. I liked it a lot.
It's very difficult to set up a story of why this group of good guys is going to fight this group of good guys. And I think, as opposed to, for example, another movie that came out this year in which superheroes wail on each other, I felt like, I mean, they spend a good first third of this film setting up the why.
Right.
And that first third felt a little slow and talky to me, but I felt like they dotted their I's and crossed their T's in terms of the why of the fighting. Gene, what did you think?
I really dug it too. And to the other movie that we shall not name has done no favors, I think, by its proximity to this one, just because it takes up a lot of the same themes, right? A lot of the themes about the responsibilities that superheroes have in the world, whether they should be reined in, who should do the reining in. That movie is the other movie is dour. And
for those who don't know, that movie is called Batman v Superman. We talked about it on this podcast,
and it is trash. But this movie is fun and funny. Even while it takes on these heavy ideas, Linda and I are, I guess, mortally opposed. She's very much Team Captain America. I am very much Team Iron Man. I think she has a great essay about what it means for friends to fight.
Right.
And to agree on so many of the principles of a thing and then come out to different conclusions.
She manages to tie that in with Hamilton. For those of you who cannot get enough Hamilton, we will link to that essay on the blog.
Right, absolutely. And it's a fantastic essay.
Yes, it is.
All things should be linked to Hamilton. But to both your points, the stakes do feel personal, right? They do right. feel like these are people arguing about a thing and they're all committed to sort of staying in the room. And that seems to be the thing, that one of the driving forces, is like whether they should acquiesce and abide by these rules set forth by the UN, in which they will sort of be deployed when the UN says they will be deployed, or whether they should go it alone as Captain America wants them to do.
Give me a thumbnail sketch of the argument for Team Cap and for Team Iron Man.
Well, since you are clearly Team Cap, it seems like.
Representing Team Cap is Glenn Weldon.
We have seen how this guy, who calls himself Captain America, whose costume is the flag, doesn't trust the government. That is, at the very least, interesting.
Sure.
Mm-hmm, but we also know exactly where it comes from, because he is a patriot who devoted himself to help create an organization called SHIELD, which we have seen blow up because it was infiltrated by evil terrorists. Blah, blah, blah,
sure.
blah, blah. So he has trust issues. It comes down to that. In the book, he was more a libertarian, kind of, civil liberties, blah, 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 blah. We get off of it as quickly as possible so we can worry about Bucky. That's
right.
Team Cap.
Right. So early on in this movie, though, Tony Stark is confronted by, I guess they have just money to blow. There's like 2 minutes of Offrey Woodard, like just as some, she has literally like 4 lines of the movie and you never see her again. But it's like, sure, let's just hire Offrey Woodard.
They've got a lot of money to spend on
this movie. Just hire Offrey Woodard to be this random person. Her son was killed by one of the Avengers escapades in the last movie, in which they drop a city from the sky.
Ultron drops a city from the sky that was created by Tony Stark in secret, who he didn't tell the other Avengers, yet everybody blames the Avengers. Small but telling point.
I went to counter with a secret that Captain America was holding from Tony Stark, but that would be a spoiler. But it is absolutely against the rules of friendship that you hold a secret like this from someone.
All right.
But anyway, Tony Stark feels this tremendous amount of responsibility for what the Avengers have done. And they've obviously blown up New York City. In one of the Captain America movies, they've blown up Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. And so he feels responsible. And he feels like they should be reined in, or at least have some kind of checks on them.
Which, again, is interesting. Here you have an industrialist saying, more regulation, which is not a thing.
Right.
This is how you can tell it's a fantasy.
Right.
Well, it does. Yeah, you're right that it does invert their respective roles. And one of the things that I liked about this movie was that Tony Stark is bearing a lot of the weight of his own bad decisions and the consequences of his bad decisions, and yet still is able to be that character, is still Tony Stark, and is still able to have a comedic lightness when necessary. In the comedy act of Captain America and Iron Man, Captain America is the straight man to the guy who gets to land all the one-liners. I think that's important, and they do it without the whole movie being incredibly dour.
Exactly. Now, I was trying to figure out, I didn't read any reviews beforehand, but I did read the headlines, and they all said, sense of fun.
Right.
It's unlike that other film.
Unlike
sense
that
of fun. And I started this film, and this film starts off relatively somber because we're dealing with ramifications, we're dealing with guilt. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to think to myself, what is it different? And then we get the Spider-Man scene. And what happens that's very important is that the tone is controlled so that when a light element comes in, like Spider-Man, it doesn't go away in the next scene. That presence of Spider-Man colors the rest of the film. The film gets, in a strange way, lighter and lighter and lighter.
Yeah.
It admits more light, more humor. We see Paul Rudd as Ant-Man. This is basically an orchestra, right? This is these are all these different characters have different power sets, they're different personalities. To bring them together in a way that harmonizes is incredibly difficult, but they pull it off. There is a set piece fight scene in the middle of this film. Odd that it's in the middle of the film, because the fight scenes that happen later are smaller, more intimate.
Right, more contained.
Yes, but this is, you know, you got the woodwinds, you got the you got the brass. It's not just a matter of like fitting them together in a jigsaw puzzle. That's the metaphor a lot of people use. But that presupposes that there's a pre-existing picture that you're just fitting things into. What it is, in any scene like this, any fight scene like this, you're building something new. And you have to understand the strengths and weaknesses of each character so that when they come together, it feels like something powerful and harmonizing. And there are so many moments in that fight scene, which are peppered with one-liners the way they are in the comics, that makes it feel like the most fully realized fight scene. Whedon did Tableau. He would show you them fighting each other, zapping each other.
You're talking about the Joss Whedon Avengers movies.
Yes, absolutely. He would show us, he would kind of slow down the camera sometimes to show us them going into battle. Great. The Russos build something. They build these fight scenes so they feel three-dimensional and real.
Yeah, I think that particular set piece that you described, which is, it's fan service and just this giddy explosion of, fight scenes can be so leaden. Mm-hmm. There's a springiness to that scene and a visual wit and weird ideas that come out.
Absolutely.
Some of the stuff they do with Ant-Man in that scene. And I'm on record. I really, really love Ant-Man. Of the movies in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, I love the way Ant-Man has this goofy lightness. And the fight scenes look unlike the fight scenes in every other movie of its kind.
Right.
And this just does such snappy work of all the different toys it has to play with.
I mean, to your point about Ant-Man, right? Like, Ant-Man gets to face off against Iron Man, which should be, on paper, is a mismatch, and it turns out not to be, right? And just, I mean, there's so many great moments with Spider-Man, but Spider-Man and Captain America sort of having that moment, like, I'm from Queens, you're from Brooklyn. Great sort of, like, and you get the sense over and over that, like, we are all fighting each other. We don't really want to hurt each other. We just want, like, you know, I mean, there's one scene when Black Widow, when she and Hawkeye are facing off, and she's like, we're still friends, right? And he's like, it depends on how hard you hit me, right? That scene is also infused with the sense of, like, again, to Linda's point, like, that they're not enemies, I mean, even though they're fighting at this point, right?
Yeah, we've talked before about the moments in these kind of films where you can feel the meetings, you can feel the studio executive sweating.
Sure.
There is a kiss. Not going to say what happens, but there's a kiss in this film that comes out of precisely nowhere. And you can feel the studio executives getting all sweaty saying, you know, there's a lot of long, lingering looks between Cap and Bucky. And don't you think this is going to freak out the fanboys? So can we just mush his face into some woman's face at some point? Can we just do that? And it happens. It just felt like a loss of conviction.
But they also, and I'm sure Glenn, you'll support me on this, they also at one point have Chris Evans clinging to a railing while pulling a helicopter in place. The biggest, like, bicep money shot.
It is, as Linda pointed out, it is fan service of a different kind.
All of my friends who were like, oh, I think I might be Team Cap now.
I mean, if the guy writes into his contract that he's not going to take his shirt off, if he's going to be that big a diva, then you just put him in some tight t-shirts and you make him hold the helicopter and it's fine.
Now, you mentioned, Glenn, that you can feel the meetings. Obviously, this thing is designed, like all these other movies, to have many more movies built on top of it. And it is laying the groundwork for future films. There are going to be at least two more Avengers films, which the Russo brothers are also going to direct. There's obviously, they're going to be doing more with this Spider-Man character who is going to be getting his umpteenth reboot in one that we're going to be excited about.
Yeah, but this is how I knew the film knows what it's doing. When Tony Stark asks him how he got his powers, and he says, it's a long story, and we move on. Yeah, we're like, yes! There was a cheer in the audience.
Yeah, absolutely.
But they also are laying the groundwork, clearly, for Black Panther.
Yes.
Ryan Coogler is going to direct a Black Panther movie. Gene is now under the table. He's so excited. Starring Chadwick Boseman. I know you love biopics. He starred as James Brown in Get On Up.
And Jackie Robinson.
And Jackie Robinson in 42.
But he's your biopic.
I wanted so much more from him. So glad that he gets to be a fictional Black superhero as opposed to actual real Black
But what did we think of the groundwork that was laid for Black Panther in this movie?
So he's, I mean, a badass, right? I mean, and one of the things about this movie is that they don't really explain sort of the power sets. It's not really clear what he can do vis-a-vis, like, Bucky and Cap. But there's that one scene when they're running, there's a car chase, and they're all running at, like, 45 miles an hour. And I was like, I would watch this for 2 hours. It was unbelievable. There's going to be a whole bunch of world building that needs to happen there. We sort of get glimpses of Wakanda, which is, I guess, a sort of isolationist African kingdom. One of the great things about this movie is that even though there are, like, a million people in it, they all are giving little character arcs. And so Black Panther is one of the eight, or, I mean, I don't know what the A plot is. Well, there's an A plot, but there's a bunch of sort of,
I mean, Captain America's name is in the title.
Right, but it's actually more about Tony Stark in a lot of ways, right? Mm-hmm. But Black Panther gets almost like a fully realized, like, I mean, his plot is a complete arc. Chadwick Boseman sort of gives it, like, a lot of gravity. You get a sense that he is both a deeply committed, that Black Panther, T'Challa, is committed to his father. Like, they only, and they do that really briskly, right?
Yep.
They set up, like, his bond with his father really quickly, and then they just let him go.
That is a really hard thing to do
Absolutely.
In a movie with 11 other superheroes
Absolutely.
Who are fighting. To also establish that there is this character that you have not seen in any of these movies before, and all of a sudden, you're not only going to see him fight, but you have to learn who the heck he even is.
Right.
For a lot of you have to start from zero with that character.
Absolutely.
Well, I am sure, based on box office totals, that more than a few Pop Culture Happy Hour listeners have already seen Captain America Civil War. So come and find us on Facebook and share your opinions. That is facebook.com/PCHH. And when we come back, we will share some of Linda Holmes's interview with Captain America's directors, Joe and Anthony Russo. So stick around.
Support for Pop Culture Happy Hour and the following message comes from Wells Fargo. Wells Fargo understands that you work hard to get the most out of life. From starting a business to saving for retirement, there are a lot of things you want to accomplish. Working together, Wells Fargo will take the time to understand what you're trying to achieve to help you reach your financial goals. That way you can care for the people and things that matter most. Learn more at wellsfargo.com/together. Wells Fargo. Together, we'll go far.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. I am here in the studio with Linda Holmes for our next segment.
That's right. Hey, Stephen. So I enjoyed hearing all of you guys talk about Captain America Civil War.
Did you agree or disagree with everything we said?
Everything that everyone said, I agree. I just want to correct Gene. I am not necessarily strongly Team Cap. I am Team It's Very Complicated. That's the team that I am on. As you hear this, it's been a little over a week since on May 5th, I sat down with Joe and Anthony Russo, who are the directors of Civil War. So we got a chance to talk at the University of D.C. in an event that was sponsored by Smithsonian Associates, which is a group here associated, of course, with the Smithsonian. And we got to talk about some of their process for making this movie and some of their feelings about the tone of this kind of movie. But then also they talked quite a bit about kind of state of the industry, both in film and in television. As you probably know, they've made lots of TV. They directed the pilot of Community and the pilot of Arrested Development and lots of other good stuff. So we got to chat about a whole bunch of different topics, and I think that you will find a lot of this interesting. So let's take a listen.
How do you feel about the significance of humor and jokes in an action movie? Not necessarily an action comedy, like, you know, what we think of as an action comedy, but an action movie generally, because there are superhero movies that are super dour and have no jokes.
We like very balanced storytelling. We like very well-rounded storytelling. We believe you should experience the whole package in a film, like meaning that you should be able to laugh, cry, think, be scared, cheer, whatever. You know, the more range of emotions you can experience as you're watching a movie, the better. And that just comes from our passion of what we like to experience when we're in a movie theater. So we do like to balance things. And we do like the later movies. That's the other thing we love about our favorite movies are movies that you can go back and watch again and again and maybe take something away new every time you do. I think that's the other reason we like the later movies with a lot of different experience, emotional experiences, ideas, etc. I think one thing that we think works real well in the movie is that it does get very tense, very, very dark. I mean, in a lot of ways, it gets darker than any Marvel movie has yet. Because there are different characters in this movie, some of whom are tied into that very dark storyline and some of whom aren't, we have the ability to toggle back and forth with various storylines between moments of real tension and darkness and moments of real levity. Both of those expressions are being very truthful to what's happening in that narrative moment with those characters, but they stand in like stark contrast to one another. I think it's very effective in this film. The comedy almost works as a tension release. It allows you to breathe for a second and go to a different place emotionally, which I think is part of the fun of the film.
I think thematically, it does come down to a balance that is really hard to strike, because you want that argument between those two guys to be a real argument, right? Mm-hmm. And to me, one of the most surprising scenes in the movie involves a kind of a discussion between everybody, which I sort of felt very startled by, because I thought in the middle of kind of a movie of this budget and scale, you don't often see just a bunch of people sitting around talking about what the right thing to do is.
This would be in the take your medicine section of the film, by the way.
Yeah, but it was great.
Yes.
It was great,
yeah,
though.
Oh, yeah, take your medicine.
Because it's people arguing. I love people arguing.
Cool. Well, it's, you know, you have to enunciate the problem, and you want... The movie is about challenging Cap, who is a patriarch of the Avengers. It's about challenging him by forcing him to choose. And he has to choose between his old family and his new family. That's not giving anything away. That scene is about them enunciating what the ideological problem is with the Avengers. You know, the movie gets much more emotional after that point. It was very important to us. We didn't want to make a movie where characters were arguing about politics. We felt like, you know, you'd last about 10 minutes and walk out the door. But it is interesting and is necessary with a character called Captain America to always introduce politics on a thematic level. We can't escape it.
Right, yeah. In Winter Soldier, one of the things that I thought was so interesting about Winter Soldier was a lot of the visual stuff with the, in this, when you were with S.H.I.E.L.D. looking out of those glass windows, that stuff was all very like parallax view to me and very like, especially since, you know, you're in this, kind of in the 70s. You guys talked about being in the 70s, paranoia thriller. Are there similar kind of influences on this film that you think are identifiable outside of kind of the other Marvel stuff?
That movie we thought about very specifically as a political thriller, and we looked to sort of the golden age of political thrillers as a big inspiration on a stylistic level and a texture level. Moving forward in the Civil War, we started to think about this movie very specifically as a psychological thriller. It goes to a very personal place at the end of the film. It involves sort of very complicated emotional revelations to the characters that become cathartic at the end of the film. We did pattern it on, you know, it's another favorite genre of ours. And we were thinking about movies like Seven or Fargo or even Brian De Palma's Blowout.
When you see the movie, they'll make more sense, these references.
They're all connected. No. We even look at, honestly, in this movie, we all even thought about movies like The Godfather simply because we had so many characters. And again, we were premising this as a family story and the fact that we had parallel stories going on following different characters through this story. So, you know, we do like the reference. We're film lovers. We love the reference movies. We find like it's a great shorthand when we're collaborating with people in order to use movies as references because it helps everybody sort of drive at ideas, connect on ideas in terms of how you're trying to work, especially in these movies where you are, you know, you're collaborating with an enormous number of people. It takes so many people to make big complicated movies like this that having a language and a shorthand with everybody helps.
Yeah. Is there any part of you that hesitates even for a minute when they originally say to you, do you want to come make these movies for the next, what turns out to be a long period of time? I mean, it seems like a dumb question, but I wondered anyway.
They're physically draining. Anth and I laugh, you know, because we spent 10 years in television. And in film, they have country club hours compared to TV. Working on shows like Arrested Development or Community, where we're always under the threat of cancellation, is a very stressful environment.
Yeah.
You make television for 8 months a year, network television. You're constantly prepping an episode, shooting an episode, and posting an episode for 8 months. So it's very, that is the by far and away the hardest job in the film business. So working on movies, we feel like where you have a year to prep and plan, 6 months to shoot, another year to post the movie, it's a more protracted process, it's a more linear process. It's easier to focus. So, and on top of which, I've been collecting comics since I was 10 years old. These are some of my favorite characters when I was growing up. So having the opportunity to work on these movies is a dream come true for us.
Joe touched on an interesting detail. Like, I think the difference between our TV work and our being at Marvel is we did work that we're very proud of and happy with in television, but they were shows, but the three best known shows, Arrested and Community and Happy Endings, you know, all of those shows always had the guillotine over their heads. You know, it's a tough environment to work in because you're kind of disposable. You know, it's like they have shows lined up behind you and they're not quite sure how long they're going to keep you on, blah, blah, blah. You're more of a pain in their side. Well, the nice thing about being at Marvel is like, it's, you know, these movies are too big to fail. Everybody's all in. So it doesn't mean they can't fail, but, you know, it's a very nice environment where everybody is fully committed to making the movie work creatively and being a success.
Cool. Well, this is one of the things I was going to ask you. Is it seemed very specifically like you guys had gone from a situation where you're making television where the respect and the love is there, but is the audience going to be there? To these projects where the audience is going to be there,
right?
You're not going to open a Marvel movie and nobody goes. But the question becomes, what are people going to say about it? How are they going to feel about it?
It's a very vocal fan base, that's for sure.
But I think that's what you're talking about is something, maybe a lesson we learned making Winter Soldier. You know, the fact that that movie worked and worked so well, you know, I think gave Joe and I a lot of confidence to be even bolder in our choices with Civil War.
Yeah.
You know, so Winter Soldier was a big step for us. They were taking a, you know, Kevin Feige is a very brave studio head, brave producer, a really clever guy. And he said he wanted to take a gamble with us on that film. And we knew we had a lot to prove. So, you know, it was a cautious, complicated process for us making that film. The fact that it worked, you know, I think gives us a lot more
leeway
and creative freedom and you know, to push things farther, which I think we pushed things quite a bit in Civil War, and hopefully the audience will still be there.
The other thing that we've learned too, and this is something that, you know, was a hard lesson to learn, is that whenever we tried to make material where we were anticipating what the audience wanted, we failed. And every time we made something that appealed to us, and then hoped that other people, it would appeal to other people as well, were always our best successes. And so we feel like with both Winter Soldier and Civil War, because we're fans, we just made the movies that we wanted to see. We treated the characters the way that we wanted to see them be treated. We worked with the characters that we wanted to work with. We told the stories the way that we wanted to tell them. And then, you know, you keep your fingers crossed and you hope. But we have found that that's a better recipe for success than trying to anticipate.
Yeah. If you had a big slider and you could slide it in one direction to make that fan base more invested on average, and the other way to make it a little bit less invested on average, would you move them at all? Would you leave them right where they are?
I'd leave them where they are, frankly. I think the fan base is incredibly invested, and that's what we love about it. It's a very great question, by the way. After 4 weeks of questions, that's one we haven't heard. So I like this question. I think for us, I went and saw Empire Strikes Back 6 times in one day when I was 10 years old. You know, we make these movies trying to give people the same feeling that we had when I sat in Empire Strikes Back 6 times in a row. You know, what it was about me that, you know, motivated me to do that and spend an entire day of my life watching the same narrative over and over. We love the fan base. It's why we make these films. They're not easy. They are very physically draining. They're hard to make. They're emotionally draining. You're dealing with a lot of pressure. You know, it's very rare that once the budget's accounted for and the P&A, the advertising's accounted for, this is like a $1 billion bet by a company. It's an incredible amount of pressure on all fronts. And we fought very diligently to make sure that the third act of this movie was not your traditional structure. It's not a safe third act. It was difficult for us to get this movie made. It took a lot of will. But the reason we do it is because ultimately, at the end of the day, this is a public medium, and we enjoy sharing the movie with audiences. We enjoy their response to it, good or bad. We enjoy their passion for the material.
I do want to ask you a couple things about television.
Right.
It's interesting to me that you made this move, that you sort of started out making like these great, like I said, great loved television shows and have moved into film, while so many people who have done great things in film are going
moving to TV.
Are going to TV.
Yeah. That's a bigger conversation about the state of the business. And I think, you know, what's happening, why we stayed in television for so long is because the independent scene that we were chasing in the 90s was dying in the feature space. And as Anne said, they started hiring those voices to work in television because, you know, for years, TV was shackled by the Nielsen ratings, which is a way to, you know, it's like a great way to make homogenized television is to try to cater to advertising dollars. Once the Nielsen ratings started to die with the advent of TiVo and with cable, where there was a monetary metric for TV shows, you started to get more and more interesting programming. TV, now with the advent of Netflix and Amazon, which are very cash-rich companies when you look at their valuation compared to the valuation of, you know, NBC, it's massive. You know, that Netflix is like, you know, 10 times the valuation of a television studio. And so they're cash-rich, and the only metric they have, you know, for their TV shows, the success of their shows, is whether or not it incites a cultural conversation, whether we're talking about it on social media. It has nothing to do with numbers anymore. It has nothing to do with advertising dollars. So the content is getting more and more aggressive in tone, more experimental in tone, smarter, funnier, more interesting. I think TV is as good as it's ever been. I can't even keep up with the amount of good shows that are on television right now. What's happening in the feature space is because TV is becoming so interesting, everybody's trying to make a cinematic universe where they've got big branded IP, because to get you out of your house, because you can just sit there and binge watch House of Cards or Game of Thrones or whatever it is that, you know, it's season two of Mr. Robot, whatever you want to watch, to get you out of the house where you're going to spend a lot of money to go to the theater for a babysitter, to buy dinner, $200 by the time you get home, they've got to give you an experience that you can't get on television. So this, it's spectacle cinema. It's also interwoven stories. Like, I think why Marvel is a bit of the future of what's going to happen to the feature space is because we're all giving an emotional investment to these characters that spans years of our lives. And that incites a cultural conversation. That's the most important, you know, commodity moving forward is, are you talking about it? And who are you talking about it with? And how much are you talking about it? And because we're all so invested in these characters, we talk about them a lot. And every time there's a new event, if it is done right, it creates a huge conversation. And so I think you'll see over the next 10 years that movies are going to keep moving in a grander, more event-filled, interwoven, you know, storytelling direction. And I think you're going to keep seeing TV get more and more experimental, and you'll start seeing movies that would have traditionally appeared in a cinema are going to start showing up on Netflix or Amazon. It's going to be easier for them to get eyeballs that way.
So you still have two of these movies left to make.
We do.
So how long are you, what is the length of the commitment? How many more years are you in this world?
2038. We start shooting both movies together, concurrently. We start shooting them in November. We finish shooting them the following September. And then the first movie comes out in May of 2018. The second movie comes out in May of 2019.
But they're different stories, I thought I read the other day.
They are. They're very different stories. The reason, the only, it's, it creates a misconception that
it's
we're shooting
Harry
them
Potter
back together.
No,
they're totally different films, but we are shooting them concurrently. Look, these movies are intended to be a culmination of the entire Marvel Cinematic Universe, everything that has happened since the very first Iron Man 8 years ago. So they're very big in scope, and they involve a lot of actors. So it's very hard to produce movies like that, to make them economical, to get all those people around when you need them. So the primary motivation for blocking the two movies together is a more efficient way to block the actors' time and spend money on the actors, frankly. That's why we're shooting them.
And where you have Harry Potter, Hunger Games, where a book is broken into two films, and you know what the story is, so you're anticipating this conclusion in the second movie. Nobody knows what the story is in Infinity War. So it's not, there's not a, you know, there, it's, it,
you
there,
do, I,
and we do, I hope. Not
you're
yet.
Being very
don't
presumptuous.
But it's, so it's not that same experience where you're just anticipating, because they're two totally separate movies.
Right. I appreciate so much all of you guys coming out. I appreciate so much you guys coming.
Thank you. Appreciate you
really,
coming.
Really, really fun. Thank you so much, Sam.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Enjoy the movie. Thank you all.
A quick shout out to one of our sponsors who brings you this message, Target. If you haven't yet, you have to check out Made to Matter, handpicked by Target. Mrs. Meyer's Clean Day has a line of natural cleaners made with plant-derived ingredients and essential oils. And Toms of Maine created the most advanced natural whitening toothpaste. It's also safe on enamel and gluten and paraben-free. Check them out and the rest of the better-for-you products Made to Matter has to offer at target.com/made-to-matter.
Welcome back. It is time for our favorite segment of this and every week, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Linda Holmes, what is making you happy this week, buddy?
What is making me happy this week is a piece that appeared on Medium on Mother's Day, written by our friend Ophira Eisenberg of Ask Me Another. Mm-hmm. And she wrote a piece about having had a baby over 40. And it is a piece that includes her talking about why she never wanted kids when she was younger. And she avoids getting into that mode of, I now realize I would have been miserable if I had never had a baby. It's very much, this is what happened and this is how I felt, so this is the next thing I did. And then some really extraordinary things happened to her along the way. And she kind of just takes the attitude of like, I tried to do what seemed like the right next thing to do. And it is the very rare How I Became a Parent essay that doesn't, particularly How I Became a Mother essay, that doesn't really take a strong position about what anybody should do except you, and doesn't take the position, I couldn't have been happy if I hadn't done this. Now I evangelized all my younger friends. It's a lovely piece of writing. It's also just a really good story. It's a really absorbing story. I was really glad she wrote it. I was really glad she shared it. So it's Ophira Eisenberg. It's on Medium. It's called Inside Joke. The subtitle is My Unexpected Journey to Becoming a Mom. And it is much more different from other writing than that subtitle would suggest. So that's what's making me happy this week. Ophira Eisenberg, Inside Joke.
Great. Thank you, Linda Holmes. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
Okay, I've got four things. Now, two of them are actual strong recommendations, and two of them are rank bits of self-serving venality.
Sure,
I think that's not a bad ratio.
You know, if we can all strive for that.
Exactly. So the first one is a brand spanking new podcast called Our Debut Album. Just the first episode is up. That's it so far. But I love it. It's Graham Clark and Dave Shumka from the Stop Podcasting Yourself podcast, which I have mentioned on the show many times. They have challenged themselves to write a hit song in an hour. So they start, and there's even a countdown clock. And you hear them trying to put together a song over the course of this hour. But that's not the real challenge. The real challenge is these are two guys who are deeply funny, funny in the bones, and they've resolved that these songs will be sincere. And they're not going to play it for laughs, and they're not going to be silly, and they're not going to go for jokes. They're going to try to expose a little bit of themselves. And you hear them going back and forth as they try to work it out. And you can feel the struggle because they keep making dumb jokes.
Yeah.
They can't help it. And so it's a real back and forth. You can also get a little peek into their relationship because at one point Dave says, now, Graham, I worry that this is bad. It's a lot of fun. So that is Our Debut Album. At the end of each episode, they're going to actually make an album, and they're going to put up the songs on SoundCloud, and you can buy them and things like that. So that's Our Debut Album. There are many different Slate spoiler specials. Mm-hmm. The ones that I'm going to talk about today are about the show The Americans. And those episodes are hosted by the great June Thomas.
Yeah.
And these are not just recap episodes. It does come out with each week with a new episode, but she is interviewing both the showrunners and sometimes maybe an actual KGB agent, maybe some of the actors. And it's really, really good. This week, the reason I'm recommending this is because she interviewed Matthew Rhys, who plays Philip on the show, the lead actor basically on the show, who also directed a recent episode. And whenever you get actors or directors talking about their craft, you just scratch the surface and everybody becomes James Lipton, right? Everybody goes, it gets very precious very quickly. There's an affected quality. None of that here. Talking to Matthew Rhys is kind of a revelation because this guy is just pure weapons-grade charm. He's got that Welsh accent. He's wry. He's self-deprecating. It's just such a great episode. And, you know, it's also June Thomas is great. And she, as a very sensible northern lady, will not permit any of that faffery that other actors would do.
She is thebomb.com.
She really is.
Love
she really
June.
Is. She's really great. And that episode is great. Okay, so now we're getting to the self-serving bits. A while back, I ranked the songs of Crazy Ex-Girlfriend.
Yes, you did.
The first 10 episodes.
And you were wrong about many of them.
No, I was not. See, that's the thing. I ranked the first 10 episodes, and I knew I was going to come back to it once the season was ended. I've finally done that. I have ranked them using a empirical yardstick that is just objectively true. And
Linda's shaking her head.
And you may quibble, but you cannot say that they are wrong, because the name of this post on Tumblr at glennweldon.tumblr.com is updated, ! The 100% definitive, empirical, ruthlessly objective, I will brook no dissent ranking of every song from Crazy Ex-Girlfriend season 1. I'm just putting it out there because I wrote this for me. And whenever I write anything for free these days, I just feel my Welsh immigrant grandparents in the background going, what are you doing? So I want people to read it. So that's at glennweldon.tumblr.com. The last thing is that, you know, I've mentioned on the show many times a guy by the name of John Hodgman. He is a personal hero. He has been for a long time. I think when I first talked about him I on the show, I said something ridiculous like, he looms large in my personal firmament. I regret the locution. I do not regret the sentiment. I read everything he's ever done. I listen to everything he does. He's a great performer, a great writer. And so I'm listening to the Judge John Hodgman podcast last week, as is my want. And Jesse says something nice about this show, Pop Culture Happy Hour. And Hodgman says something nice about this show. And I'm figuring he's just being polite because, you know, he's just being a nice guy.
I thought that too.
Yep. And then he picks up a copy of my book and starts saying nice things about it. Now, he hasn't read it yet. So he hasn't finished it yet. So everything could go pear-shaped. But just that's not a thing I ever expected to happen in the world.
That's amazing.
It feels
that's
like a so fever dream, cool. But that it actually amazing. Happened. So that's it. So if you want to listen to the episode of Judge John Hodgman called All Laws Are Off, you will pinpoint the moment when I was in the gym and I made a guttural pre-verbal sound from the time before language because I could not believe what I was hearing.
I swore very loud in my car.
As did I.
I hollered and screamed in my car and whooped, and it was very exciting. And by the way, if you want to know what kind of joy you can expect from that podcast, All Laws Are Off is their alternate title of The Purge. Jesse describes it as that movie where all laws are off. He says, yeah, I think that's the alternate title. All Laws Are Off.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, it's nice. So fun.
All right,
anyway,
so that's it.
Go
that's
ahead,
so
ahead,
dope. That is really dope.
Yeah, it was great.
Congrats to you guys.
Well, thank you, Glenn Weld and Gene Demby.
I have four things, too.
Excellent.
I was on vacation a couple weeks ago in Jamaica, and I was reading Mr. Glenn Weldon's Superman book, Superman the Unauthorized Biography. It is fantastic. I was just laying out on the beach with the Caribbean behind me. So I was having a serene moment, and Glenn Weldon's voice was on the beach with me. It was a very, very, it's a fantastic book. I'm halfway through The Caped Crusade, which is a book about Batman and the rise of nerd culture.
Heard good things about it from John Hodgman.
So I'm going to co-sign John Hodgman on that. The Guardian has a great long-form story about these two young men whose parents were Russian spies, and they were actually the family on whom The Americans, which is the best show on TV, on which that show is based, and they, I guess, they're called illegals. The Soviets would send people to the States and put them under deep cover, just like as the Americans, and they would raise their children as Americans, presumably to eventually turn them into spies. So these two men who have lost their American citizenship are talking about what it's like to be in your early 20s and find out that your mom and your dad were actually Russian spies and trying to figure out what to do with the rest of their lives now that they're stuck in Europe somewhere. The next thing is Kat Chow. I don't know if you know who that lady is.
We do. She is most excellent.
Kat Chow has a really, really, really good essay in Lenny Letter, which is Lena Dunham's newsletter, about her mother who passed away when Kat was in her early teens from cancer. Her mother was diagnosed with cancer and died 2 weeks later after the diagnosis. She has this beautiful essay about her mother, and this time of year, it is Mother's Day, and these shoes, these old boat shoes that her mom used to wear, that she still has, and she still wears on occasion. I would highly recommend that.
Co-signed. I wept like a baby.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So go read that essay on Lenny Letter. And the last thing is the Code Switch podcast.
Yay!
I'm involved with a ragtag team of misfits here at NPR called Code Switch. We cover race, ethnicity, and culture.
And you don't say.
We are finally launching our podcast at the end of this month. The trailer for our podcast is up. I hope you like it.
Thank you, Gene Demby. I'm a music writer. And in the last few weeks, I have experienced an absolutely ceaseless glut of surprise, gigantic artist has new album drops. It's starting out, of course, with Lemonade by Beyonce, which is the kind of record that she released it as this long form video, like hour long video on HBO. It's very, very powerful and dark. And then you have the album, which is a different experience.
Absolutely.
And it
so
is
different.
The kind of experience. I am a big Beyonce fan.
Me
and
too.
It takes a long time to unpack everything she's doing.
Mm-hmm.
She's on top of her game right now. No sooner did that show up than another big string of albums. Like Drake put out an album with 20 songs on it, and I have not even touched it.
And neither have I. Yeah, it's so crazy.
But it's something I should probably
hear. Absolutely.
Yeah. there's a new James Blake record. It was announced on like 2 days' notice. It's interesting. I'm still no suit. I barely had time to listen once or twice before the new Radiohead album dropped. And that's been kind of burrowing under my skin. I was listening to that all day today. At the end of this week, the day that this episode drops, there's a new Chance the Rapper mixtape called Chance 3. And we're just at NPR Music, we're all starting to take on this kind of slightly hollowed out bearing of people who just can't get ahead of the news cycle because there's just always something new to process and interpret and decide whether we even like it. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it's a big glut of new music by people whose work we really like. And you know, I could certainly give you a vague ranking of the quality, you know, greater than, greater than, greater than, with Beyonce at the top. Mm-hmm. But it's just, it's an exciting time right now. And it really makes you wonder about the future of album releases in general, because we thought this was a busy season even before all these big surprise albums dropped. So that's it, a gigantic glut of new music. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow the show at PCHH. You can follow me at I Dislike Steven. You can follow Linda Holmes at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Glenn Weldon at GH Weldon. You can follow Gene Demby at GD215. That's GEEDEE 215. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy. And you can follow our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff. That's K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in-and-out music, which you are tapping your foot to now. So thank you all for being here.
Thank you.
And we will see you right back here next week.